You're listening to a Stranger podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hi, this is Jen Graves. You're listening to Invisible, the Stranger's conversation with people in art. I'm at the Fry Art Museum with Tim Rollins and Angel Abreu. Did I say it right? Kind of. And you guys are giving a talk tonight on the occasion of the exhibition here, Tim Rollins and KUS, A History. And, you know, I imagine you're going to talk about a lot of stuff that a lot of people really want to hear, and part of the reason we're doing this is because not everybody's going to be able to get in, because it's probably going to be standing room. So so basically, you know, I just want to start out and tell a little about how the two of you actually met. You're 35 or 36 now?
Just turned 36.
Okay, yes. Congratulations. Yes, thank you. And tell me your story, the two of you. How'd you meet?
Well, I was 11 years old, and in seventh grade, and Tim was my art teacher. I was new to the school, IS-52.
So this is when I was still in the school, so super early.
On Kelly Street in the South Bronx, during the very early 80s, when it was a pretty tough environment to live in, let alone learn.
Yeah. So seventh grade.
Seventh grade, and Tim was my art teacher, and I didn't know what to make of Tim at that point. He was very, very intense. I knew that I liked him right away. He was the only teacher that actually kept me interested at that point as a new student there. I didn't know exactly why, but as I got to know Tim, it became really clear that we would be lifetime friends, first off. But, you know, it was his intensity that really attracted me to him. He had this passion at the time that he could not take no for an answer. Or the words that you absolutely hated? I can't.
Oh, yeah. No, no, I don't like four-letter words like can't.
Right. And, exactly.
That was the one big rule. That was my only rule. So you cannot use that word, can't.
What, did you already want to be an artist? Were you interested
in art?
I did.
Okay. I've always wanted to draw when I was younger than that, and I was always interested in it. You know, and basically the way it all kind of came down is Tim met my parents at a parent-teacher conference, and that's where he explained to my parents what this after-school quote-unquote program that he had going, and he wanted to invite me to that, and my parents agreed. They thought, you know, it's great, he loves to draw, he's into the arts, so go ahead and go. And that first day I showed up with it's really funny, I didn't know what to expect, and showed up with the Crayola watercolor set at the studio. And everyone laughed at me when I walked in, so that was my introduction to KOS.
The rest is hysteria.
Absolutely.
I'm from the hills of rural Maine, and as soon as I could get a ticket for a Greyhound bus and graduate from community college in Maine, I decided I wanted to come to New York and study at the School of Visual Arts, and I wanted to study with two people that were teaching there at the time. First was Joseph Kosuth, so-called father of conceptual art, and then I had great love for a man named John Cage, the poet and musician and philosopher and genius printmaker and painter, and so that's exactly what I did. And it wasn't long before getting my bachelor's degree at School of Visual Arts and becoming Joseph Kosuth's assistant, so literally within 2 or 3 weeks from coming from the hills of rural central Maine, I'm going to Bob Rauschenberg's loft to hang out with him and Joseph, and then Joseph goes, listen, I'm doing a trade with an artist, and I want you to go to his studio. It's a big place, and it's on the corner of 14th Street and Broadway. And I go, oh my God, it's Andy Warhol, it's the factory. And he goes, I want you to go, and I want you to drop this off, and I want you to come straight back Which, of course, I didn't. I pretended, I lied, and I said I went to Strand Bookstore down the block, and I was hanging out there.
Did he buy it?
I totally hung out. I couldn't believe it. He was hilarious. Not for long, but it's all quite innocent, unfortunately. And then I decided to study art education and political philosophy at New York University. And after that, I took on the sadomasochistic act of deciding to become a New York City public school teacher for special education kids interested in the arts. I was essentially adopted by a very dynamic Puerto Rican American principal named George Gallego. Remember George?
Oh, yes.
Amazing guy that had grown up in the South Bronx and was one of these people that genuinely wanted to give back and actually had something to give back. And he saw me in action during a summer school program, remedial program, called Learning to Read Through the Arts. And he said, I want to get this crazy white hillbilly boy into our school. Because our school had gone through three art teachers in 1 year. I think Mr. Flores was the last one, and he was found in a fetal position in the corner because, like an idiot, he decided to do clay with a group of emotionally handicapped kids, totally unsupervised, special ed, and you can imagine what they were making, and then what they were throwing at him and at each other. I walked into the room, and I said, the principal, George, says, obviously, the place was a wreck. And he goes, obviously, the previous teacher did not have order of his class. And I'm looking at this place, and I'm going to get out of here now. All right? This is in the middle of the South Bronx, 1980, 81. Boom, boom, bang, bang. I mean, every building totally burnt out. Packs of wild dogs running around. Crackhead over here. Hooker over here. But then what you'd have is you'd have this, you know, a single mom with their three kids walking hand in hand, going to the local public school. And just trying to get a little bit of normal during the day. And I remember walking into the room, it was supposedly an art room, and they were excited because they said, we found a room that had a sink. And for them, that was a big deal. The thing they did not tell me is that the sink had no drain. So, drained. You have to laugh, or you're going to start crying, right? I'm going to break down on your cast here. And it was a big white spackle bucket. I can still see it. And the water would rush down. It was like a third world country. And I'm going, I don't know. And then I look up on the ceiling. The ceiling must have been in the room. Angel was half raised in that classroom, room 318. And we look up on the ceiling, and in black charcoal, thick charcoal, was all these graffiti tags. Some kind of good, but most of it was horrible. But I said, Georgie, the 11-year-olds, 12, 13-year-olds, how did they get up on to the ceiling to do the tags? These are old buildings, from school buildings from the early 1900s. No air conditioning or anything, and these big tall windows. And in the summer, the only ventilation you had was when you would take these long, long, long wooden poles that had a hook on the end. Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, some of your listeners will know what I'm talking about. And you would pull the top window down because you couldn't have the bottom window up because stuff would be flying out into the public. Okay, and so including some kids, and so you bring the top down, and it was amazing. They had figured out how to take the big chunks of charcoal, and with masking tape, they tied it to the end of the poles, and they got up in like late Matisse, you know, those old photographs of him and on the deathbed drawing with the pole. They would do this, and I said, George, you know, if these kids are that diabolical, that creative in order to be destructive, maybe there's something here. And George goes, I intuit this to be so.
That's good. That's good. That's how you took the job.
I was going to be the good New England white missionary Yankee, then go work with little brown children for 2 weeks and then self-congratulate myself at openings and party, you know, and
right.
dinner parties.
How, right.
Yeah, how some of us are. All right, let's get real. And I said, I'll dedicate myself to 2 weeks and we'll get a program going for you.
Oh, wow.
And then I will do my quiet retreat. And it was that first day, and I said, what I'd like to do is have, give me 10 of your most challenging students, the ones who hate school, but they might love art, or who you think might have some gift or some interest at least, and bring them on in. And so luckily I was smart enough to borrow one of the teacher's boom boxes, and at that time, this was before there were CDs, I had my cassette tapes of African Bambaataa and The Treacherous Three, and Scooby D and everybody, so I'm not stupid. I knew I was prepared. And I had brought a ream of Xerox paper because I knew for a fact that, you know, copy paper because I knew for a fact they wouldn't have anything for me. I had my own big pack, remember these, of Mongol number one pencils, the thick ones that I found a sharpener for. I was prepared for these kids. And they ran on in. And you bang, 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 you just could hear them. I don't know if you remember that movie Gremlins.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was like the whole cast of Gremlins was sitting in front of me, and they're looking at me, and I was all 23, 24 years old, and I looked like I was 10, all right? And they looked at me, and they... One kid actually said, whispered to the other, they said, he's so white, he could get a moon burn. And everyone was dying laughing, including myself. I said, I'm stealing that one. That's a good one. And they were looking at me, and I was going to be the other white meat, without a doubt. They're going, oh, he's young. Oh, you can tell he doesn't know what he's in for. You know, he's never met forces like us. He's forces like us. He has met forces like us. And at that time, I'd done a lot of student teaching, and I'd been in Bedford Stuy, and I'm coming from Maine. I really wanted to know the entire region of the Bronx, and I didn't want to hang out and just dress in black and not go above 13th Street like all my classmates from the School of Visual Arts did. And so what I had enough training to know to put on the teacher death mask face, the expressionless face, like you don't know if I am a sniper or a serial killer or I must be crazy because I'm here. Why would I come here from Chelsea on the 6th train?
I wish people could see your face right now.
That's a scary
scaring
face.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
And so I put that face on and I said, I have you here for an hour and I have one thing I would like you to do. And what's that? And I remember taking the paper and just slapping a whole inch of it in front of all, you know, 10 kids. Bam. Bam. Very dramatic. Bam. Bam. Angel's nodding because he remembers.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and they had never seen so much paper in their life. All right? Like an inch of the paper. And I said, this is what we're going to do in the next 45 minutes. You will make the best drawing you have ever made in your life. They go, now? Now. Boom. Start blasting the music. And you know what? They looked at each other. He's crazy. He's crazy. Right? He's crazy. Yeah. We don't know what to... Well, what is this? We didn't let him in the school. They check his ID. And you know what they did? They made the best drawings they ever made in their life. And I'm walking up and down the aisle with my expressionless, death-masked teacher face on. And I'm Baptist, so we call this shouting material. I just wanted to jump up and down. They were making those beautiful, amazing things you ever saw. And we had just furious, furious, furious. And then tap, 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 you hear... Just blasting, and you can't hear a word. Not a peep. And all the other classroom, you just, it's pandemonium. And the supervisor comes on in. Is everything all right in here? Everything's fine. Because the music's a little loud. And I said, I'll see you later. And I just put the door in his face. Because I was going to be there for 2 weeks. So I was just right. Get off my behind. And we got done. And everyone's looking at all the stuff. And, like, they said, nobody ever made us do something this good. I said, it's okay, you know, what you're doing is okay. And it was this kid, who we still know, he's a cop now, Carlos. He goes, can I ask you something? And I go, what? He goes, we're good, aren't we? And I said, no, you're all right. Same face. Hell no, we're real good. And you know what? You know we're good because it's written all over your face. And I got so busted. Can I ask you another question? I said, as long as it's not personal, you know what I mean? And junior high, yeah, don't ever go there. And he says, are you going to stay or are you going to leave like all the rest? What a manipulative little so-and-so. I mean, just guilt-tripping me into the future. And I said, I'm only here for 2 weeks. And they said, can we ask you another question? They're all huddling. And then and Carlos was the alpha dog. You know, every class has their alpha dog. And so he goes, can I ask you another question? I said, what? And he goes, would you stay? I said, you call me crazy. You call me so white that I'll get a moonburn. And now you're asking me to stay. He said, just forget about all that. Would you stay? I said, I'm here for 2 weeks. No, but, you know, listen, would you stay? Well, let me think about it. And I went downstairs. There's George Gallego, like, grinning, big, big grin on his face, rocking in his little, you know, corporate principal chair, the only nice chair in the school. And he's smiling and he goes, they're good, aren't they? I go, George, my mind is blown. There is so much work to be done here. And he goes, I have a question for you. I go, what is that? And he goes, listen, would you stay? I know you said 2 weeks, but would you stay? I think we really need you and the kids need you. 4 months later, I found out that Gallego had planted the question in Carlos, and the whole thing was a total setup to lock me in to that school. They were slick.
That's good.
That's uptown.
That's good work.
And that's it. That's it. 7 years later, there I was, and we started KOS in 1982 as a group, and then we left our studio with a grant from the only people that ever believed in us, and that was the National Endowment for the Arts. $8,000 grant that I raised and matched with artists' money, people like Jenny Holzer, Nancy Spiro, Leon Gallo, Joseph Castu, Rauschenberg, people that had this belief in the vision, parents, I mean, and my own salary, and I wasn't making not even $18,000 a year at that time as a full-time public school teacher, 1981, 82. And now we finally got our own studio in the community in 1987. Then we got another studio in Chelsea in 1994. And I'm happy to say that I guess we're going into almost our 30th year of work, and we are now in the permanent collection of 95 museums worldwide, and we are totally thrilled to add our experience at the Frye Art Museum here in Seattle, which is Angel's second home. He lived here for 12 years, and we're just honored and thrilled to be a part of the community for the amount of time that the show is exhibiting.
I know there were hard times.
Yes.
And I know there were more than one. But thinking in particular about the little guy who was killed.
Christopher Hernandez,
thank you. And then also just some controversies about kind of coming into the world and making a big splash, and also probably you had some difficulty dealing with the art world.
They had a difficulty dealing with us, just our own existence.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask, I guess, is on the, you know, in terms of the art side of things, how do you feel like the art world has changed, or has it? I mean, has it actually become more open due to kind of projects that have been going on for the last 30 years of these kinds, because a lot of projects have been happening, not just educational projects, but a lot of projects intended to open the art world. John Cage is actually a great example of that early, you know, kind of impulse. But I wonder whether those things become exceptions, and then the art world still sort of stays the same, or whether the art world becomes a bigger tent. You know, which is it? What have you seen?
I remember someone, a well-known artist, talked to me a month ago, and we were at...
Who was it?
I shouldn't say. Actually, I will say it's Ashley Dickerson.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Dickerton?
Yeah, Dickerton, sorry. And we were showing together in a really major show in England, and it was called New York Art Now, and it was at with the Saatchi Collection. Mm-hmm. And Ashley was part of it, Bob Gober, Peter Halley, Jeff Koons, Philip Taff, Kay West, and myself. And it was funny, we were at this opening, and it was a very diverse crowd, and it was, and Ashley says, you know, Tim, I remember that in the early 80s, when there would be events like this, the only people of color in the room would be your kids. Fascinating. I never even thought of it that way, because we're family, and I just didn't see it that way. And it's funny how he saw it that way. Mm-hmm. And there are many more. I don't like the metaphor and the simile of the pioneer and all that nonsense. We just did what we had to do with what we had. I'm from Maine. And when you want to build a barn, you don't get a big committee together to study the feasibility of barn building in this particular property. You don't study the theory and practice of 19th century and 20th century barn building in New England. You don't read essays like The Barn and the Other, right? What you do is you build a damn barn. And if your barn's broken, what do? You fix it. And so that's all we did, is we built a barn. And we never did studio visits. We still don't. And it's something about what we were doing that was attractive to many, many people and repulsive to a whole lot of other people. And if you had a problem with us, frankly, that was it. That was your problem. It wasn't our problem.
I never, you know, in retrospect, I don't think I ever felt like I did not belong. And kind of looking back, 12, 13 years old, I mean, to have that thought that I could walk into a gallery in Manhattan, and feel like I actually belong there. And we would get looks, but I don't think I ever felt like this should not be happening.
But this changed.
Because you sort of had your own studio. You sort of had your own stuff going on. You had a place.
Exactly.
And we were recognized for that. Mm-hmm. But something really turned, and we were talking about it earlier today, is that one evening we were invited, KOS and I, about eight of us, and I took the older members, and we head-to-toe suits, we looked fantastic. And we were invited to the VIP opening of Jasper John's retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art. And we were guests of Agnes Gunn, who was the president, and Wendy Whiteman, who Angel actually babysitted her kids. She was a curator of prints and drawings, and we have a very strong relationship with MoMA. I mean, they have every print we've ever made. We have two paintings in the collection. So here we go on in. And I'm walking in, and everyone's walking in, and we have the invitations, and the KOS members, who are now young adults, and, you know, older teenagers, are literally bum-rushed by the guards. Let's see these. Where did you get these? That's all I could hear. The invitations.
Yeah, the invitations in our hands.
Right. Where did you get these? What are you doing here? Mm-hmm. The first thing was the hurt of just that, by my young folk being, you know, these are my sons, you know, being selected, right, profiled. The second really hurtful thing is that all the guards looked like they could be the fathers, I mean, ethnically,
right,
the fathers of,
right.
They couldn't imagine,
right.
They could not imagine,
sure.
You know. Dennis Cinchon, one of the guards who actually taught some of these people out of it, was one of Angel's classmates. IS-52. He's still a guard there at MoMA. That's where he went. And I remember, Angel can talk on this, but I had never seen Angel angry. Really angry.
For me, Jasper Johns is just my hero. I was 15 or 16 at the time. I can't remember exactly how old I was. And I was really excited to see the show. We walk in, and to have someone that looks like me, I mean, And this goes back to what I was saying about never feeling that I did not belong. And I can't remember. It's probably the first time in my life that I just can't remember ever being so angry before that point. And you know, it's mostly because of my upbringing. I did grow up in the South Bronx, but my parents really kind of isolated us. We didn't hang out on the streets. We just
You were in the studio.
We were in the studio or
every
in our
night,
apartment.
Doing homework and, just, and then straight to your apartment.
You know, so I never really, we were kind of insulated in a lot of ways. And so this was my first confrontation like this. And I was angry.
It ruined the entire evening. And of course, I talked to the president directly the next day. And I heard there was something of a dressing down of the guards the day after that. I can't prove that, but that's just one specific incident.
Sure.
Where
but would that happen today? That's kind of what I'm asking, you know.
Would that happen?
Change?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
How about, this is something I want to ask you. You know, The Stranger is probably the gayest newspaper in America. Probably you know that already.
I have no idea.
Really?
Yeah,
Dan Savage is the editor.
Oh, great. I'm sorry, I had no idea. You should have.
Yeah,
he comes
you really should have.
Yeah, asked some questions to him.
How about bringing together the world of, like, gay and black guy? Black teenage guy. Like, how's that work?
Well, it's funny because I don't really identify as... I don't identify. So at that time, I was actually in a long-term relationship with a wonderful woman named Kate Pearson from the B-52s, mm-hmm. and we were together 15 years, and that was mainly during the time I was beginning to teach. So of course, everyone's completely confused, and now I'm in a relationship, long-term relationship with a terrific artist in New York, and I live in the South Bronx now. I actually lived for 10 years there in the neighborhood I used to be so afraid of. And so, yeah, things obviously have changed, and it's not. I'm still the only white guy around, but I got a little bit of a legacy. I got my ghetto pass a long time ago, and I think that was, if there was any issue, it wasn't so much an ethnic issue as it maybe. I know we've had some parents that they kind of figured some stuff out, and even the kids figured it out. And I said, when they're old enough to ask a question, I always tell them the truth. And I always said, I will always tell you the truth, but don't, you know, I'm still kind of country, and I got that wonderful, you know, there's a little bit of tea party in me that don't fence me in. And mm-hmm. So it's not that I identify, and it doesn't have anything to do with my pedagogy or my work, but even you might see some people are forever looking for subcurrents and subconscious themes in mm-hmm. the work, and I don't know if it resonates that much. I'm just an educator that loves his kids and happens to be in a gay relationship right now.
How about I have two questions. I don't want to forget either one of them, but I'll just ask the first one that's on the top of my head, which
sure.
is: did you read all the books?
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
And I always wondered whether everybody actually read all the books.
And it all depended on the on the level. No, and that's
Tim's
it.
Tim's shaking his head.
Not everyone read the books, and it depended on the level of. I mean, we would read out loud. We literally
would read
out loud. I personally did read all the books.
So we should say, just by way of introduction, that all the paintings are based on stories from classic books.
Right.
And
music.
Go ahead.
Right.
Yeah.
Carlos Rivera was dyslexic, so he really could not read.
Right, yeah. I wondered that when I was watching the documentary.
Yeah, yeah. So
we would read aloud, and I would make my own books on tape.
Because, oh, really?
Yes, because I had... Mm-hmm. We, in the early 80s, that's changed wonderfully now, too, but it was a real strange system that started with Reagan, and we had experts being paid tens of thousands of dollars to tell us what our kids could not do, particularly kids so-called of color. Mm-hmm. And in low income, I don't use the word poor, I use low income, in distressed communities. And mm-hmm. I think many kids were diagnosed as special education because that's where the bucks were. The more special ed kids you had, the mm-hmm. more financing you could get for maybe just you know, getting toilet paper in the toilet. It's a very strange time. And so I think what was really important at that time was the fact that, you will be taught and you shall be educated by any means necessary. Mm-hmm. And I always got this stuff, you can't be teaching Melville to Carlos, he can hardly write a sentence. And I said, well, okay, that's true, and he really has been diagnosed as a correct diagnosis of being dyslexic. But if that is the case, how come he can memorize a Tupac Shakur CD, side A and B without one flaw? How can he do that and be so-called illiterate and unteachable, and you're just writing them off because it's convenient? I'll be honest, to be convenient. I tell people that I stopped being a teacher a long time ago. 20 years ago, I stopped being a teacher. I've been doing this over 30 years. After my first 10 years, I became an educator. There's a difference. Teachers show you things. They connect you to resources. They are showers of the word, but educators are doers of the word. Education comes from educare, which means to draw, which, to make a mark, and to draw water from a well, like I did in my great-grandmother's house in rural Maine. That was my job. It's metaphoric, and it made a great indentation in my professional subconscious, is that I was the one that could lower the bucket just perfect and tip it just right and get the biggest amount of water, and knew how to slowly, patiently bring that bucket up without spilling one drop. And that's what I feel like I do with each and every member of the group that I become in long-term contact with. We started out as a special ed class. And then we ended up being kind of a fraternity when they all were in the teens and early 20s, and now they're having their own kids, and now we are a full-blown family.
Do new members come in? What's the makeup of KOS now?
Young teenage members, or no?
Sure. Actually, we're about, in the next 2 weeks, I think I have one good generation in me left at the age of 54.
You've got a lot of energy.
I'm not stopping. Not now. And so we are going to start with a whole new group, a master class starting, I want to start a little earlier, like 11 or 12. 13 is a little late. I had to learn the hard way. In the neighborhood where I live, and so we're going to have, not a junior member, but the range will be 11 years old to, Rick is the oldest, at what, 38? 37? He'll kill me if I get 1 year off.
38.
Yeah, he just turned 38. He started when he was 13.
Mm-hmm. You know? Is it a living for anybody who's in it, for everybody who's in it? How does it work?
Sorry, do we make a living just from the project?
Yeah.
Never.
No.
Never.
I'm a you knew the answer to that question.
I wish. There was a point in time, which I would say the apex, professional apex and the financial apex, it's probably around 1989 and 1990.
Around the
DIA? Yeah, thank you. That was the where we were showing at DIA. We were in the Venice Biennale. Mm-hmm. We were in the Carnegie International. Mm-hmm. We were in the Whitney Biennial. It was our moment. We were showing.
We're just getting started with Mary Boone. I mean, there was all.
Yeah.
Internationally, we were, and it was wonderful. And what that did, that helped pay everyone back for the 10 years that we did this on nothing, and I ate spaghetti every night. Mm-hmm. Thank God I love pasta. And then all of that really came crashing down around 1992 and 93. And the worst was 94, when we lost our studio. And I was, not to get the violins playing, but, you know, I was actually homeless for a year, living in and out of studios and with friends. And it was, you know, and everybody went and got jobs. Angel, you were just starting college, right? Mm-hmm. And then everyone else, you know, did what they did to get by. But, you know, looking back, it was an amazing test, is the genuine dedication and belief and self-faith and group faith that we had in the project. Because, yeah, we lost some folk, but then we got some folk. But several of those crazy knucklehead kids you see on the cover of the exhibition catalog at the Fry, a lot of them are still working with me, and they're having their own kids, and it's a very, very beautiful, exciting thing. And I have to tell you that after 30 years, I feel like we've just begun. Mm. There's a breakthrough coming. I feel it. We're in it right now.
What are you working on?
I don't want to jinx it.
Okay. What about you? Where did you go to college, and what's your life like?
Well, I went to the University of Pennsylvania mm-hmm. for a few years. I think I've been to every college on the Eastern Seaboard. Spread the love around. I went to University of Washington very briefly. I'm painting, so I'm just working with KOS and doing my own stuff on the side.
Yeah, I missed him when he was in Seattle. And
12 years you were here.
I was here for 12 years.
What got you here?
My wife.
She from?
She's from Southern Oregon.
Okay.
And so when she graduated from school, and the idea was I was going to finish up here at UW, mm-hmm. We both were really kind of sick of New York. And things weren't really happening with KOS at the time. It was a rough patch. And decided Seattle would be a good place to spend some time. Mm-hmm. And we're here for 12 years. It's amazing.
Wow.
How time flies. And, I just holed up in my little tiny makeshift studio that I made and just painted and bartended. And
Where did you tend bar?
At Flying Fish for a little while. Mm-hmm. A little while. It's there for 5 years.
He's a restaurant celebrity. I can't go anywhere.
Word
is hit town. Right? We get free appetizers everywhere.
That's awesome. Yeah. What was or is the actual biggest kind of impact on your life of this, this project? This is the biggest one. I mean, I know there's probably a million.
The biggest, and I knew this actually before I started KOS, but my experience with KOS really solidified this is, and not to sound cheesy, but my undying love of art. I mean, I can't shake it. Mm-hmm. I can't shake it. It's part of why I moved back to New York.
Mm-hmm. That seems a good place to end.
Beautiful.
Thanks, you guys.
No, great, great questions. Thank you. It's so wonderful when you get real questions.
Yes.
No. Thanks for listening, everybody.